Phillips Brooks expressed it so succinctly. Do not pray for easier lives. Pray to be stronger men. Do not pray for powers equal to your tasks. Pray for tasks equal to your power. Then the living of your life shall be no miracle, but you shall be a miracle. Every day you shall wonder at that which is wrought in you by the grace of God. The burden of every member in a Christian group should be trusting God for miracles in men, in me. Whenever God changes any individual in a group, He changes the group. As the individual matures, the group matures. There is no ministry apart from men. Yesterday we asked the very practical question, what is a group? We discovered, first of all, a group involves people. People who are different, dramatically different. And these differences account for the distinctives and the dynamics of a group. A group has dynamics because the people are different. There's a difference in background, a difference in need, each individual a world of need, and vast differences in personality. And as we pointed out, we must become not only students of our message, but also students of men, of the people to whom we wish to communicate this message. Now, this morning, we want to look at a second distinctive feature of a group. Not only is a group comprised of people, it must also have a clear-cut purpose. Lorne provided an excellent biblical backdrop for this and last night's message. We don't beat the air. And much of Christian work is characterized by what I call the slimy ooze of indefiniteness. There is a lack of accomplishment, which is the result of good intentions without exactly knowing what, how, and why. The result is you end up with a group keeping mental housekeeping in a revolving door. You develop a brand of individual who has both feet firmly planted in midair. This is a subtle thing. I'm committed to a personalized ministry, to a ministry with groups. But I have discovered if you do not have clear objectives, you are just as foggy working with individuals and with groups as you are in preaching or teaching to 500 without an objective. See, it's possible to have the objective to work man to man and never get the job done. I was discovering that I spent a lot of time with men, but I had no accomplishments. My objective was to spend time with men. But it's got to be more sharply focused than that. When you spend time with men, precisely what do you hope to accomplish? When I convene a group, what is my objective? Where am I going? I just dropped out of a group not too long ago for this very reason. They met the first Saturday of every month. So one day, I asked an ASCII question. I said, men, what's the purpose of this group? And the chairman of the meeting said, Brother Hendricks, that's a very insightful question. Brother Brown, you've been here longer than anyone else. What is the purpose of this group? And Brother Brown stuttered and stammered for a while. And then he said, well, Brother Jones, you've been here as long as I have. What would you say is the purpose of the group? And he was equally veiled. We went all the way around the group with no one able to express what's the purpose of this group. When we got all the way around, I said, well, the motion is in order. I would like to move that we disband this meeting. Oh, no, we can't do that. Why not? Well, we've been meeting for 12 years. Well, I said, that seems to me like we've got 12 of the finest reasons why we ought to quit. This group needs a quiet committal, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. Oh, no, we can't do it. So I bailed out. They're still meeting. Every Saturday morning. My friends, do not multiply meetings. Make them meaningful. You have no right to ask an individual to come to a group or a personal counseling situation unless you have taken the time to formulate some objective. The goals of a group must be well formulated. They must be clearly understood. They must be personally accepted. Well formulated, clearly understood, and personally embraced. We've asked a question here in terms of the purpose. Does everyone accept the purpose of this group? Well, this depends on a number of things. In fact, it depends on three searching questions. Number one, do your group members understand the group's purpose? Not enough to have one unless they understand it. Why are we meeting? Secondly, do they feel that the purpose is important? And my friends, this is very critical if you are going to reach intelligent people. Now, you may get a collection of individuals with about 80 to 85 who will meet just because you suggest they meet. They enjoy the fellowship. But if you're dealing with a group of people with 130 above, I'll clue you, they're not about to meet unless they are convinced that this is a worthwhile meeting. This is a place where I want to put my time. And there isn't a person in this room who's even had a limited exposure with the NAVS who hasn't proven this firsthand. And that is, you've got somebody in your group who's plugged into you and plugged out of the church. Because he thinks what's going on down at the church is Mickey Mouse. And he thinks what's going on in your group is really significant. And that's why he comes. If you cannot communicate to this individual, this is worth a night of your week, then, my friend, you are culpable before God by dislodging this man from his home. I will never wrench a man away from his home unless I have a worthy objective, because I'm complicating his problem rather than solving it. He needs another meeting like he needs a hole in the head. But he needs a cause to which he can commit himself. The third question you ought to raise is, does he feel the purpose can be achieved? In other words, are we shooting for the moon? Or do we have this thing down where we can get a hold of it? Now, I'd like to give you three questions that I use in determining whether you have a good objective. I will not allow an individual in my training program to go into any group or to work man-to-man with any individual without showing me and convincing me that he has a worthwhile objective to spend this man's time. And there are three characteristics of a good group objective to me. Number one, it must be brief enough to be remembered. And this is sometimes humorous. I asked a man not too long ago, he was leaving the seminary, what's your objective? Oh, just a minute, Prof, I got it right here.
Hold it.
You got it right here. So you can't remember it? Yeah. It's right down here. I wrote it out. Five sentences. He said, my friend, if you can't remember it, I got news for you. You'll never accomplish it. So you got to go back and say, now let's see, what was that there I'm going to accomplish here? Yes, here it is. Read it. Walk out. No, it's got to be right here. And I often say to this guy, look, my friend, if I come over to your home at 3:30 in the morning and stand you on your head and say, boo, what's your objective for today's meeting? You'd spit it out like that. I was preaching some time ago in a pulpit in a rather large church, and I was completely derailed in the middle of my message. For I moved my Bible up and then exposed a little plaque on the pulpit. And the plaque read, what in the world are you trying to do to these people? Next time I saw my pastor friend, I said, friend, what in the world is the point of this question on the pulpit? He said, I was preaching for 12 years in this church without a clear-cut objective every time I walked into the pulpit. So I devised this question so that every time I look down, it forces my hand. What do you want them to think? What do you want them to be? What do you want them to do? And my friends, if you don't know, there is no baptism of understanding that takes place at that door. It's got to be brief enough for you to remember it so that you go in consciously to accomplish it. Second characteristic, it must be clear enough to be written down. Now, a pencil or a pen is a mental crowbar. It forces you to think, and to think clearly. It was Socrates who said, generalities are a refuge for a weak mind. If you run that through your mind, you'll quit saying, and so forth. Which is usually an indication I can't think of anything else. Clear enough so that you can write it down. I have a lot of fun in marriage counseling because I give a lot of homework. And this is the way I get people to internalize their problem. A lady walked into my office some time ago. She said, "I want out." I said, "You want out?" "I want out of my marriage." "You mean you want a divorce?" "Right." "Well," I said, "that's serious, madam. We better sit down here and find out why." I said, "I take it you're disturbed with your husband." "Oh, tremendously so." I said, "Okay. What is it that bothers you about your husband?" "Oh, everything." "Well, name one thing." "Oh, I just hardly know where to begin." "So that's all right. I don't really care. I'm..." just start anywhere, madam." "Oh, my, so many things. It would take me an hour to do it." "Well," I said, "fine, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you an assignment. Before you come back the next time, I want you to write out on a card exactly what it is that bugs you about your husband and why you want a divorce." "All right." So she took off, and I got this feedback later. This really threw her into trauma. She was really shook up. She worked 12 hours trying to devise this list. And she'd read it and then tear it up and start over again and draw up another one. So finally she brought the list in. "Here was, boy, the list. Wonderful. All right, lady," I said, "let's discuss these things. Now, let's see. Point number one, the reason you want a divorce is that he won't pick up his pajamas." That's what she had down. What's the matter? We strike oil here? You must have stepped on somebody's bunion over here. I hate to talk in terms of personal needs, but... See, I'm reading this to her. She wrote it down. "He won't pick up his pajamas." "Now, as I understand it, this is the reason you want a divorce. Is that right?" She said, "That's kind of silly, isn't it?" Tremendous insight. Now, if I start out by saying, "Now, look, madam, how stupid can you get? You want to get a divorce because he won't pick up his pajamas. Is that it?" See, then she tunes me out. That's the last I hear from her, and she hears from me. She just goes, gets a divorce. And don't laugh, because every day of the week in Colorado Springs, Dallas, or your community, there's somebody getting divorced for just as ridiculous a reason as that. See, it never got clear enough where they could get a hold of it objectively, have somebody else play it back to them. And I'll tell you, my friend, it's an exacting experience to write down your objectives. I hope you appreciate the process through which some of your leaders go to make your work most meaningful. And these men who are really hacking away at trying to get some clear-cut objectives in terms of what do we want a contact to be and what do we expect a representative to do, this is agonizing. This is hard-nosed thinking. You put it down and you whack away at it and you correct it. It takes a lot of noodling. The interesting thing is when you finally get it down, you start accomplishing it. And that's exactly what happens in your group. You get it right down here. I know what I want to do. And the interesting thing is you go in and you do it. The third characteristic, it must be specific enough to be achieved. Specific enough to be achieved. In other words, it must have realism to it. And ideally, it must have some bite-size elements. There's a great danger in this type of thing of frustrating people with objectives. Boy, I've seen people tubed out with a set of objectives. It's so far beyond the guy, you know, that he looks at these things, ooh, way up there, well, you know, we'll never make it. And he does make terrific progress, but in comparison to where he's going, you know, you can hardly see any gain. So he throws in the towel. Will you bear in mind that what you are trying to do, first of all, is to find where you, the individual, the group, where they are. The next thing you find out, where are you going? To find out where they are is why it's so important to know people. To find out where you're going is why it is so important to know objectives. And this is a process so that we have to set objectives for this level, which are achievable. Then we draw up a set of objectives for the next level of development. The reason why you are able to do certain things at this level is because you have accomplished your objectives at this level. If you fail to accomplish your objectives at this level, then you arrest the person's growth. Give you a choice illustration in terms of our teaching at seminary. Down here we have courses in Greek and Hebrew. In our seminary program, you take 4 years of Greek and 3 years of Hebrew. You know, there's no problem at all teaching Greek. Greek is very simple if the person knows English. You know our biggest problem in teaching Greek? They don't know English. So there was a failure back here in the course of his education, and we pay the penalty. And he fights the rest of his time trying to get this thing under his belt. And I've seen in an organization like this where you're trying to develop a team, man, way back here in the earlier stages of your first recruiting, you fail to accomplish basic objectives. And the result is these things plague them all the way down the line. Now, will you bear in mind that purpose always determines procedure? Now, if you look at this chart, you will note that as the group changes, that is, as it moves up this ladder, your objectives change. As your objectives change, your procedures change. Next hour, I'm going to share with you some procedural techniques for getting participation. And I'm going to give some of them to you, and you're immediately going to react and say, but you can't do that. No, you really can. Down here. But you can up here. In fact, you must up here. But you will never accomplish it up here unless you have basic objectives down here to prepare the way for it. Concepts are developed like layers of an onion. And sometimes, to develop this individual, you have to blast before you can build. Your biggest problem educationally is dislodging error. It's not implanting truth. It's relatively simple to explain the gospel. Your problem is, after you go through the whole thing, he says, yeah, that's terrific. I remember I was baptized once. So we go all back over the thing. He says, yeah, that's boy, I really appreciate that. I joined the church when I was 12. You know what you're doing? You're explaining the gospel, but all the time you're dislodging these things, you see, that have been deeply entrenched in his thinking as to what the gospel is. And before he can sometimes embrace what the gospel is, he has to find out what it is not. And this takes a great deal of time. This is also the reason why, in teaching, you want repeated exposure. And I would suggest this principle. You ought to emphasize at each of these levels intensive rather than extensive learning. It's not that you teach him everything he needs to know, it's that you teach him what he needs to know at this level well. I have a friend of mine who is with the publications department of the Southern Baptist Convention. They put out these little training booklets. You've probably seen them. I said, what is the lifespan of one of these training booklets? He said, about 6 years. I said, what do you do at the end of 6 years? He said, we pull it. We reassign it to another individual who writes precisely the same thing, only in a different format, different illustrations. We put a new cover on, we put it out as the new book, and everybody takes the course. He said, Hendricks, after they take it 6 times, even the most stupid begins to understand. Now, you think he was being sarcastic. He wasn't. He was being very insightful. And that is that you build concepts like layers, and you repeat, and you repeat. And even though you move on to this next section, this next level, you still go back to clinch the basics, to clinch the objectives back here. Because when do you get to the place where you don't need to be reminded of the importance of a time of personal fellowship with the Lord? I've known some seminary professors who could profit from this. You never get to the place where you get beyond the point of knowing the importance of prayer. So you continue to repeat these, but you build upon them. You teach intensively what you want to teach at this level. Then you move on to the next level. Now, I want to give you 3 stages of getting an idea across, and then I've deliberately left some time today so that we can take some questions before we move into our last session. There are 3 general stages through which a person goes in the process of receiving an idea. The first stage, he rejects it. Boy, this will save you a juicy set of ulcers. You ever go out into the ministry believing that when you talk about navigator principles to an individual, when you're going to share with him some of the basics, you're automatically going to meet with resistance? You just put it down. If it doesn't come, it's a fringe benefit. Now, you see, this takes all of the pressure out of your presentation. If I go knowing, first time I talk to this guy about this, he's going to say, yeah, that's very lovely, but... And you've already got the resistance. So you don't say, well, they never told us this at the Glen. You know, I sort of got the impression that once you learn the basics, go out and sit down with any 12 people and they'll say, woo, where have you been all my life? They may say, from what planet did you come? You mean we really need you? Boy, this is tremendous to get across to pastors. If I ever get the guy to realize that the first time he walks into that board, they're going to oppose it. What? They don't even know what they're opposing. This is just par for the course. I used to have a guy on my board. I'm telling you, this guy was as psychic as I've ever seen an individual. He must have had prophetic gifts. He knew before I even came in what I was going to talk about. And he was opposed to it. That's it. I remember we were trying to develop a youth program. Now, you, young people, we're doing too much for it. When I was a young person, we didn't do all that. So, you know, you come in the next time, he takes the 2x4 and drops it on your head again. And finally, I went to an older minister, and I said, "Hey, buddy, I got problems." He says, "Really?" That little benign smile of profound insight. And I shared with him my problem. He said, "Let me suggest something for you." He said, "Why don't you start a corps of prayer warriors and ask this guy to be the first one to sign your list?" So I went back. I started a corps of prayer warriors, people who would covenant to pray every day for the teenagers in our group. And I went to him. I said, "You know, I don't know anybody in this church that's more interested in our young people than you are. Nobody talks more about them than you do." And I said, we have some real need for prayer, and we're trying to get a corps of people who will covenant to pray every day for this. And I'd like you to be the first to sign the list." Well, as an elder in the church, I mean, you know, gonna have him over a barrel. "Okay, we can sign it." So he signed it. And I'd feed him little cards like this. "Pray." And the old guy started to pray. You know, I've been to Texas long enough to know, friend, that a horse can't kick and pull at the same time. It's a very important discovery. And one time, we were having a social down in the basement, and this old guy stuck his nose in. That was the first mistake he made. And we were playing a game, and there was a little teenage couple coming around, and as they saw him stick his nose in, they pulled him in and put him in the game. He never had so much attention in all his life. You have to know his wife to appreciate this. And the interesting thing is, this guy got on the inside, and he got an altogether different perspective. You know who are the people who have all the answers of working with young people? I'll tell you. The people that aren't working with young people. They know exactly what to do. Church is overrun with what I call self-appointed fruit inspectors. Constantly running around lifting up people's leaves. "How's your fruit?" And they are usually people who are rejecting people. The second stage they go through, and sometimes this takes quite a bit of time, encouraging to know, they tolerate the idea. I mean, they give up on it in the sense that, okay, so I should have a quiet time. I mean, you know, this, I mean, I'm not fighting it anymore. I finally threw in the towel. I don't have one. But, I mean, I tolerate it. And furthermore, I might even allow you to talk about it. Might even invite you to our group. It'd be very nice to have you talk about the quiet time. Since I'm not doing anything, I think it's terrific that you would talk about it. And it's very interesting to watch this guy as the wind goes out of the sails and he just sits down. And he listens. See, the first time we brought it up in the board meeting, he went for your throat. And the second time, he up this side, down this side, and it kept on going. Now, you've siphoned off a lot of the venom. And now he sits there when you talk about it and grunts. The next stage through which he goes is to embrace it. He resists it, he tolerates it, finally embraces it. And if you can hang on long enough, because with some people this is a rather extended process. I've had students for 4 years going through this process. And the interesting thing is that when I finally get a convert, he's stronger than some of the guys who in the first class said, man, that's what I want. See, I walk into a class and I expose them to this stuff and they go right up through the ceiling. They come right up out of the chairs. They fight like tigers. They go back and forth. Man, we really have sessions. And the interesting thing is to see this guy going through. And by the way, some of them graduate from the seminary still resisting. And they go out into a church and they get the baptism of fire. And then everything comes unglued, and the guy says, good night, where are those notes? Where are the notes? He's writing me a letter, he's calling me long distance. Hendricks, you got one book on Christian education that will solve my problems. Now, this is also one of the values of a reality-oriented type of approach where you dangle them in rote. We got 42 men out this summer in churches across this country in an internship program. I can tell you exactly what's going to happen next fall when these guys hit the campus. They're going to have the kerosene poured over them and the match lit to them, and they walk into a classroom to hear everything you got to say. Because all of a sudden they now see it in terms of what we're facing out there. And before, yeah, nice ideas. See, he's a nice person. He tolerates me. I mean, I'm one of the penalties en route of getting his degree. Now, if you can get this perspective, man, this will take a lot of the inordinate pressure with which some of you people get plagued. And the reason why often somebody wants to bail out of the NAMS or bail out of the church or bail out of whatever he's in, and that is he's lost his perspective. You're going to get resistance. It is a part of the process. Then you're going to get people in a stage where they're just tolerating it. They're, you know, in neutral. If we can just get the gear in, even into love, as far as embracing it, we're making some progress. And eventually to high. Now, we've got about 10, 15 minutes here, and I deliberately scheduled this time because I want to give you opportunity to ask some questions, which can relate either to the purpose, to the people who are involved, some other aspect that we have discussed together. Yes, sir. Very good insight. It is most important that you have the ultimate. I do not always share the ultimate with this individual at this time because he's not ready for it. See, that helps me because I know where I'm going. It may frustrate him. So I really reveal it to him just in bite-sized forms. Yes. Precisely. If they can go through the process of formulating this plan themselves, then they are the ones most interested in carrying it out. Right. Otherwise, what is it? It's your plan. It's what happens to a preacher who goes into a church. It's his program. So it all comes crashing around his head. People say, what happened to your program, Pastor? That's well stated. Because it's his, it's not theirs. And when he leaves, the program falls apart. This is the danger of a pastor-centered church in which the whole thing is built around him, or a leader-centered group in which everything is so built around him that when you take this dynamic out, the whole thing comes unglued. Yes? That oftentimes I want to work out a program with this man on a personalized basis. He may be in this group, benefiting from the group processes, but he's also going to grow on an individual basis. So I would want to deal with him from both standpoints. Yes,
We talked about gifts and coordinating all in the body of Christ functioning in the group. Could you give us an idea of when you're working with an individual, how you help him discover his gifts?
Sure, I'll be glad to. First thing I do in helping a person discover his gift is to teach him the scriptural teaching concerning gifts. Before he knows this, he's not going to find anything. That's the first place I begin. And I would say the primary passages, perhaps I referred to these. Did I? To review, what are they? Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4. Now you have other passages, but these are your primary classical locations. And I would study these. All right? That's right. Yeah. A number of us have been talking about this, and there are differences of opinion on this. It is my judgment that we overemphasize the difference to the exclusion of seeing it all sourced in God. For example, that a person has the gift of teaching who was saved when he or she was a public school teacher doesn't disturb me at all, because I happen to believe in the sovereignty of God. So it's no problem to me that God gave this person gifts, which he sees now in a spiritual frame of reference, with spiritual dynamics, the power of the Spirit, the ability to teach the Word, not just science. So I don't make the disjunction that some do. I recognize there are clear-cut spiritual gifts which are listed in the Scriptures. I'm not sure this is an exhaustive list. I'm not sure it's even intended to be. And I think there are many things. My brother's ability here in art, I can't find listed unless you put it under the general category of the gift of health, you know, in which he is helping someone who is functioning with another gift. But I mean, it could be a natural talent which he now sees with a new dimension. In fact, that's what's turned him on. He was just about ready to quit because he said, how can I use my art for God? I mean, his point was, why don't I go get into something else where I can use it more? Well, this is a question of exposing a man. All right, first of all, the scriptural teaching. The second thing is exposing an individual to a variety of experiences. I think this is very crucial in determining one's gift. And my illustration is usually this. Man says to me, I don't have the gift of teaching, when I talk to him about the possibility of teaching. I say, how do you know? God let down a sheet out of heaven one night and tell you this? Oh, no, no, I just don't have it. How do you know? Oh, just know. So did you ever teach? No, I never have. Then I don't think you can tell whether you have the gift of teaching or not. Some of the finest teachers we have in some of our classes right now, if you had said to them 5 years ago, my friend, you have the gift of teaching, you know what they would have said? I know one gift you don't have, the gift of prophecy. You know what their reaction is? Who? Me teach? I got a guy right now in insurance executive teaching classes. I send my students out to watch him. He's so fantastic. I put him in the midst of the seminary students and say, become like him. This guy is tremendously communicative. 7 years, exactly. 7 years ago, this guy had never taught once. And if you had asked him, as I did, what about teaching? Thanks a lot, Howie. I love to administrate. It's my field. But not teaching. Of course not. Never been exposed to it. I want to add one other dimension to this. And I think this is crucial, and you're going to run into it all the time. I do not think because a person has the gift of teaching, he can therefore teach at every level. Let me give you an illustration of this. We had a guy teaching in our junior department. He's a graduate engineer. And the kids were climbing the sides of the walls. And he was tearing his remaining hair out. And I can still remember him coming in with the quarterly, and he throws it down on the desk and says, "Hendricks, it's 30. I'm through." I said, "How come?" Well, he said, "Did you walk by the junior department recently?" I said, I just can't control them. I'm just out of it. I don't have the gift of teaching." I said to him, "Mike, I'm not sure." I said, "Maybe we have you in the wrong place." And right about that time, we were thinking of starting a college department. And, you know, the wheels started going around. And we put this guy into the college department. We got 64 college kids and started with two. And those college kids think this guy hung the moon. He's got real long words, and they think it's tremendous. They don't understand them always, but whoo. It's a real thinking man. Got a thinking man's filter. Evolution, friend, hit him anywhere. That guy will tackle any question you give him. He reads, he studies. Those kids latch onto him. They're over his home till the middle of the morning. They go to the university and get shot out of the saddle. They come running back to his place. And he gives them answers for all the questions that people raise who have scholarship to ask questions but not scholarship to answer them. Universities are loaded with these people. The shoddiest form of scholarship. Because of this guy, and boy, this guy really thinks. Whoo! He goes back to campus, charged up again. We got a class out at SMU, I tell you, it's a Lulu. One of the humanities courses, it's a required course. Last time the professor started the course, the first thing he did, he said, "How many of you kids in here believe the Bible is the Word of God?" And these little kids from Methodist churches, you know, in the boondocks out in Texas, they put their hands up like this. "So you know what I think of the Bible?" Takes a Bible like this and goes, like this, right through the open window. This is the way they launch the class. And these little kids from Chigger Creek, Texas. Batten their eyes. Wow, we lose more evangelicals in that one course than all of the university put together. It's a deliberately devised course to ask kids. And for the first time, we've been plugging up the holes. And you know who's been doing it? A guy who said, "I don't have the gift of teaching." And he sure does. And if you're talking about teaching juniors, they think he's from off the ark. Boy, these college kids. Third thing is the recognition of spiritual gift by spirit-controlled men. This is the first thing we ask in an ordination exam. Are there any spirit-controlled men who recognize you have the gift of preaching? My friend, if you're preaching for 5 years and there's nobody filled with the Spirit who recognizes you got the gift of preaching, I got news for you. And this is one reason why a group is essential as a therapeutic corrective agent to help people. To recognize these gifts. And then the fourth and the last reason I give is the leadership of the Holy Spirit in your own life. And this is why it's so important to be under His control. And a number of us were talking after one of the sessions about thrilling realization of the Spirit of God developing peace in their own heart. This is their gift, and it's often a narrowing process. It's conceivable you may have a number of gifts. But the Lord continues to lead you till finally it's this one I want to use and invest my life in. I have been in the pastorate and in preaching. Nothing I love more. I left preaching, in the sense of a church, to go to a seminary to teach. Seminary is constantly trying to get me into administration. I think I have abilities in this area, but I don't want to move in that area. My greatest satisfaction and fulfillment in dependence upon the Spirit is teaching. I live to teach. And if I'm out of the classroom for 5 days, I'm very difficult to live with. I'm difficult to live with, period. This is my bread and butter. I live for this type of thing. I can teach or preach in one church. I can teach in the seminary and move into hundreds of churches through a ministry of multiplication. That's what you're interested in. So you keep asking yourself and the Spirit of God as you're in fellowship with Him, what is it, Lord, you want me to do? I have no axe to grind. I'm available for you. I would say these are the primary means, Bob, that I would use. May I share just one thing and then we'll take us a break? And be sure to come back on time, will you, next time? Because, man, I'm loaded for bear, that's all. Whoops. Meanwhile, back on the ranch. There we go. What's his gift? Different groups serve different purposes and therefore take different procedures. I deliberately devised a group which I call information giving, which as near as I can determine would be a good illustration of the type of group you often begin with in terms of the basics. In other words, you are dealing with a person who knows nothing. And you are going to give him some information as to how to get into the Word, as to how to start a memory program, as to how to establish a systematic quiet time. And it is primarily one-way communication. Now, we do not mean to imply by this that this could not be followed by question and answer. But you see, it is ridiculous to start with an individual who just received Christ as his Savior and say, let's have a discussion on the quiet time. On the what? Quiet time. I'm not a very quiet person. So he doesn't know what you're talking about. He needs information. Now, look at the same structure from a different standpoint. Now you are not facing with this individual with information giving, but information selling. Now you have two-way communication because you want this person to react in order to find out whether you're coming through or not, whether you understand what you're talking about. Let me show you two others in the realm of decision making. Here you are meeting as a group of representatives in an area. Area directors. You get decision making. You are exploiting the resources of your group so that out of the center of this discussion will come meaningful decision. By the same token, you may be involved to solve a problem. And I thought of a good one last night as Warren was talking. He said, it is our goal to revise the TMS. That's a problem-solving situation. That's where I want to get the guy that's right down at the grassroots level to talk to him. What are the problems you face using this thing? What are the limitations of this? So you have problem solving in which you have interaction across this entire group, moving in every conceivable direction. Not one way. If this man makes a statement, this man answers him. I don't think that's right. And I'll tell you why. This man says, well, I'm not too sure about that. And this man says, have you ever considered this? And it's in this cross-pollination of ideas that you really come to the solution to a basic problem. So your purpose determines your procedure. When you change the purpose of the group from a information-giving session to a problem-solving group, you have to change the procedure. Now, next hour, we want to look at some of the ways of securing participation in these groups.
Facts of the matter are, the students think we're stuffy. We're removed on some cloud from where they live. That's what's coming through. See, so sometimes in connection with these, they may be wrong. Other times, we may be projecting the wrong image. Okay, what else? Come on, some of you deal with pastors. These are the guys that really give it to you. Yes, sir. Walt? All right, maybe we could put this narrow under this.
And even isolationist under that same coin, I think. We've been accused of this a lot of stuff.
Isolationist?
I had in mind, for example, one time I were accused of being a scoff of the body of Christ.
That's a delightful... Where's your public relations man? Be sure to put that in the next bulletin. George?
I think
that another one here would be anti-church. And that's why pastors are gung-ho for you.
Tell you, friend. See, I'm viewing it now from the other side to help give you some evaluation. I get this shoved down my throat all the time. And I tell you, not because I'm trying to impress you, but because I don't mind coming to the defense of something I know is not true. But boy, an awful lot of people across America think you're anti-church. So whenever they see a nav walk in the door, that's a threatening individual. See, he's not going to help me. In fact, he probably thinks you're going to hinder him. Well, if you're going to hinder me in my work, you think I'm excited about you? So my first task is to get across to this guy. I'm on his team. I want to help him. Well, if you ever get this across to him, you talk about communication. And you've taken giant steps. Anything else? Can come sometimes with unguarded remarks, even about a person who has some training. I think, for example, and I think this is true, I know it's true, I think there are many navigators that I have met who know a lot more about the scriptures than many individuals who have graduated from theological seminaries. But I would never suggest you tell somebody that. You believe that's true? Have you met some? I know a man graduated from a theological seminary with several advanced degrees and enrolled in the topical memory system in order to get some scripture under his belt.
That's true. But there's a difference between a true fact and the type of thing you project on individuals. And you go out running all over the place saying, boy, you went to seminary, you... or a graduate of this school, you don't know from hunger. See, boy, that goes down real hard. It's awfully hard to choke down. I mean, it's a blow to his pride. May I add that most of you are working with adults. And there's one good thing to keep in mind about working with adults. The greatest problem in adult learning is saving face. He does not know what he doesn't want you to know. He doesn't know. So you never start out by saying how dumb you are. I mean, he knows that.